Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
Welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias. My guest today, Connor Doherty, is an economics reporter with The New York Times, and more importantly, the author of a new book, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. The book is about housing.
The book is about how housing got all messed up in America.
And the
end
metaphor,
of the American dream.
The Golden Gates.
Yes.
There's a bridge.
Well, the Golden Gates is, the metaphor is that cities have become so expensive that we have erected a set of gates around them in the form of high rent and home prices.
I met you in the city of San Francisco.
Yes.
Where the Golden Gate Bridge is.
On purpose, there is no Golden Gate Bridge on the cover.
Absolutely.
Because we did not want it to seem like a tour guide.
Which it is not. But San Francisco is ground zero, both in some ways for a housing crisis that occurs in many places, but particularly for a political counter-mobilization.
Exactly.
Which a lot of your book is about.
Well, because if you think about it, for 40 years, there has been recognition by various economists and policymakers that there is a housing problem, that there's a housing shortage, and that this is unnecessarily raising prices. And interestingly enough, that recognition begins in the Bay Area. I found a bunch of books where people were talking about this. Famously, the New York – famously now, anyway. At the time, it kind of went under the radar. But the New York Times wrote a headline in 1981 that said, changing San Francisco is foreseen as a haven for wealthy and childless. So this problem has been going on for a long time. And so it makes sense that the place that was always the worst would have the – early kind of indications of a housing crisis. Matt, I should say, we kind of have a conflict of interest on this housing podcast because you are you are a bit character in the book. But the jokes aside, there was a lot of writing, there was a lot of discussing, and so what I think I kind of tried to do, at some level, what this book is a question, which is how do policy thoughts become real movements. Mm-hmm. And I had known as a reporter, I'd read your book, The Rent is Too Damn High. I'd knew Ed Glaser for years. So I was well aware of this issue. I'd, you know, like I said, I was reading people like you. I was reading economists. I was super well aware of this issue. And I think maybe even I wrote a story about it or two for the Wall Street Journal. Mm-hmm. But they're always very boring stories. They were always economists say blah, 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 you know, and there was not much you could add other than this is a huge problem. I wish people were worrying about it, but they're not.
Right.
So let's move on to the next problem. And I think your own book even has this – I remember the end of your book. It goes something like, well, normally this is the part where I have a bunch of conclusions about what we're supposed to do about it. But all we're really supposed to do about it is talk about it and raise awareness of it, and that's as much as we can do.
I mean, this is the sort of transmission belt of ideas, right? I had read a lot of economics literature.
Yeah.
That was like, ah, this is the problem. So then I tried to write for a, you know, popular audience of people who care about politics. Like, this is what economists think about this. But there was no story to cover, right? Like, we're journalists, right? It's like you want to write about, like, these people are doing this thing, but nobody was doing anything.
Totally.
So the end of my book was like, I don't fucking know.
Yeah, exactly. No, totally. And actually, I think some of there's a lot of history in this book. It's not a history book by any means, but we kind of go back and look at how things happen. The one history in this book that is totally original, meaning I had not seen it anywhere, is this transmission of ideas. There was this guy named Bernard Friedan, who in 1979 wrote this book called The Environmental Protection Hustle, which despite the horrific Fox News title is a very reasonable book. And he kind of says the Bay Area has this huge housing problem. NIMBYism is a huge problem. It's kind of amazing, like a lot of things, how much people identify very early on. And uh-huh. He says, and the problem is the people who don't live somewhere yet can never organize, so this will never be solved. And this may turn out to be true. But anyway, so then that guy ends up having a student named Ken Rosen, who was an economist at Berkeley. Then Ken Rosen had a graduate student named Larry Katz, who is now this famous economist at Harvard. Larry Katz went to Harvard. He worked with Ed Glaser. And then Ed Glaser started writing about this and being interviewed about this, and that led to people like you and Ryan Avent writing about it. And then suddenly there I am in the year 2013 or so, thinking to myself, wow, everybody has fondled this topic as much as humanly possible. There's nothing you can even write. Maybe someone comes up with a new study and you could write about, like, Moretti and then came out with new studies that said, actually, the cost of NIMBYism was $1.7 trillion. But it was always like, which new paper are mm-hmm. you going to write about? That was like the state of the journalism, which is a pretty sorry state of things. So then one day I met Jeremy Stoppelman, who is the founder and chief executive of Yelp, and he told me he had given money to this woman, Sonia Trauss, who ran the Bay Area Renters Federation, or BARF, famous acronym now. And I thought, this is the first time I've heard of someone who's not just very engaged in this issue at an activist level, but is hyper aware of the housing shortage as an issue. It's not just they're complaining about the rent being too high or something like that. It's not a proxy indicator. It's they are trying to attack this root thing that all these economists have been talking about for years and years and years. And I just dove in. I immediately started following her to Board of Supervisors meetings and all these other things because it was the first time. And it's kind of funny. When I wrote that first story about Sonia for the New York Times, a number of people, local San Francisco people, were like, you just wrote an article, a big article in the New York Times about like a crazy person. Because there are crazy people that show up to the Board of Supervisors and say all sorts of stuff. And you just kind of, I mean, there's a guy named Starchild who was actually hanging out with, that's his real legal name. And he's a kind of, he calls himself an erotic service provider, but he's a prostitute in San Francisco. And he goes and shows up to every Board of Supervisors meeting. And somebody said, your article on Sonia is as if you wrote an article about Starchild, as if he's this political movement. But the reason I knew that wasn't the case was I did know all this research. I did know that for decades people had been taught that this was a real thing that very serious people were very worried about, including the Obama administration.
Right. That's the thing, right, is she has something of the temperament of the neighborhood meeting crank.
Yes.
Who is a personality that is known to residents of every American city. But this is actually an idea that was certified by the majority, I don't want to say all, but the clear preponderance of the well-qualified experts who have looked at this subject. I'm not going to go, I assume in some of your interviews you get actually more into this stuff. In case you have somehow never heard an episode of this show before, quantitative limits on the supply of housing lead to scarcity and price problems. And that is the policy background. But the point is, so you see Sonia, right? And she's showing up and she's talking about this stuff, and you know that this is like the consensus in the academic literature, and you've also seen like the White House, you alluded to this, they put out this little report.
They had put that out right when I met Sonia. So,
there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like the top, the political system at an elite level was starting to say, maybe we should do something about this problem that has been identified a long time ago. And then you have Sonia, and she is actually doing something.
Totally. And for me, I mean, to be totally honest, I just wanted a way to get my rip on the story. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, as far as I was concerned, I wrote one article about it for the New York Times, and I thought it would be a one-off.
Uh-huh.
But then more stuff happened. Oh, well, so after the article ran, this person in Boulder writes me a note and says, hey, we're doing this Yimby Town conference in Boulder. Do you want to come? And I was so worried I was going to waste the New York Times' money in going to Boulder that I actually found a whole other story in Boulder, and that way I could rationalize the cost of the trip. Because I was convinced I would show up and it'd be like four people in a bar being like, yeah, I read that article. It was great, you know? But no, it's like 200 people. there was the I remember the mayor or the former mayor of Sitka, Alaska was there. The mayor of Boulder was one of the people who had organized there, the former mayor. People from all over, pretty much every city that housing is screwed up, Seattle, Austin, Portland, Boston, take your pick. And then even some of the southwestern cities like Nashville and stuff. So there, Minneapolis, there were that's not in the Southwest, but a lot of smaller cities too.
Sure.
So I was like, wow, this is a real thing. This is crazy. This is becoming, I don't know if the word movement is right, but this is becoming a new political constituency that is worth looking at. So then of course, inevitably, they started clashing with tenant groups a lot. There became all these fights. And that led me to just sort of treat the whole story. And that pretty much is what led to the book. But it all began with this idea, which is how do I see a policy idea in action and really the creation of a new political constituency? And I think one of the reasons this has been so contentious, as I'm sure listeners to this podcast are aware, there has been this ongoing fight between what are called the YIMBYs, the yes in my backyard, the people who are fighting for more housing supply, want to deregulate housing in cities, and the anti-gentrification groups, which think that this will just raise prices even more and encourage more people to move to the city and demolish rent-controlled apartments and all this other type of thing. But I think that the reason, beyond the reasons I just stated, that this fight has been so contentious is that, you know, there are political alliances that form for historical reasons. And once they form, they become pretty comfortable. They're just convenient and people know how to deal with it and they know who to call and whatever. But for this YIMBY thing to be successful, they kind of have to break that thing up. Mm-hmm. They have to take an old alliance and split it down the middle and peel off a bunch of people. And the process of that is violent and messy and, you know, not literally violent, but it requires – you know, kind of some brass knuckle politics stuff.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the situation on the ground in California, because both sides of this are sort of more advanced there than on the East Coast. Because one thing is that there's a much more robust rent control infrastructure in San Francisco in particular, and I think in California generally, than we have sort of left in most East Coast states, right? You have a large constituency of people who are in rent controlled units.
In the actual city of San Francisco, it's a ton of people, including, by the way, a ton of the tech people who everyone hates, right? So, I'm joking, obviously, but, you know. I went all around the country for this book. I spent a lot of time in Minneapolis. My wife is from Minneapolis, so I spend a lot of time there just naturally, and I got to know a lot of people there. And as everyone knows, or listeners of this podcast, one of they recently became the first major city to essentially get rid of single-family zoning.
So in Minneapolis, they sort of had the biggest, clearest political success.
Yes, Oregon too.
Yeah, right. But I think in part because in Minneapolis you didn't have the rent control constituency. So the you know, when Sonia names her group Bay Area Renters Federation, right, she wants to say she is representing the interests of renters versus single family homeowners. And in Minneapolis, you sort of could generate that political cleavage.
Totally. So anyway, all I wanted to say is that I went all around the country for this book, but I ended up doing most of it in California because it was the same story, but just in like slightly more muted, more frankly boring tones in other cities. And I did not ever find a place where the story was materially different. It was just a little like quieter, right? Uh-huh. And so the stunning thing about the story was how the same it was everywhere. It's funny because every city is so different. Their local policies are so different. They'll tell you some historical reason why the city is so different than every other city. But it's not. They're all the same. They have a bunch of single family homes and they consume most of the land. And anyway, so the situation in California is super bad. The rent control, and as you just alluded to in Minneapolis, so Lisa Bender, who is the president of the city council in Minneapolis, she's kind of like the renters people. She had like a tenant bill of rights. And she's also like the YIMBYs people.
Right.
And that same politician can be like the vessel for all these interests, as you just said. And in San Francisco, that's like not possible. You are either the tenant person and you hate real estate developers and all real estate interests. I'm being a little neon, but not that really. And And or you have to be the developer shill. And, you know, even if – and even, you know, nonprofit affordable housing developers in San Francisco are regarded with some degree of suspicion. So
– the established battle line in San Francisco housing is tenants versus landlords.
Exactly. And single-family homeowners are just allowed to sit off to the side and say, yes – landlords are horrible and tenants should, you know what I mean? They're just, they're just like, they're allowed to be Switzerland. And I think what pissed so many people off about Sonia was she just like pulled them into the fracas and was like, no, you're the problem. You know, and that was the declaration of war, if you will.
And I mean, the reason they're the problem, right? Fundamental, because you get it, right? Like if you live in an apartment and somebody is raising your rent, the person who's raising your rent is your landlord.
Yes.
Not a single family homeowner three blocks or a mile away, but it's the single family homes. Like, why are they fundamentally the problem?
Well, so they control all the politics, basically, and that's through voting. So that's natural. That's not on them, right? I mean, if you are an engaged citizen, good for you. but in most cities, even to some extent in New York, where you're from, most of the landmass is these kind of single-family home neighborhoods. It's like about 75%. It's about three-quarters of most cities. And this is what leads to this problem we have, or I don't know if you want to call it a problem, but all around America, there's a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. In the Bay Area, it's south of Market. In the D.C., it's the Wharf. In Minneapolis, it's the North Loop. In New York, it's Hudson Yards, where it's some former industrial district where they decided, oh, we're going to put the tallest, fanciest possible condos in that neighborhood. SoMa is the one in San Francisco. And that is seen as, you know, basically solving the problem.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't solve the problem. And in fact, it just leads to these things that truly are luxury housing.
Right.
And when I say luxury housing, I mean like $9 million penthouses and stuff. In San Francisco, essentially everything is called luxury housing if it's new and market rate. But I actually, in my mind, try to make a distinction, and this is something I think gets lost. If they're building a bunch of $3,500 one bedrooms for techies, I think that's by and large good, meaning there's huge demand for that. People will rent at those prices. They will live there. They will contribute to the local economy. They will work, whatever, right? All this stuff. When you start building like condo buildings where the cheapest one is the $3 million one and the top is $25 million or $40 million in some cases, that really is just like some giant foreign investment vehicle. Maybe policy should be trying to build a lot fewer of those on what is, you know, the public's land to some extent, even though it was privately owned. Anyway, so I think when Sonia came along, she drew these battle lines and she was so – I mean, one thing about Sonia, one of the thing that makes her amazing as a character to follow in journalism is I don't think she's even capable of being duplicitous.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, like at one point she filed this lawsuit against this suburb. She was clearly – filing the lawsuit so that she'd A, get attention, and B, create a nonprofit that she could essentially steer donations to and employ herself in activism. And she would say like, oh, well, I filed the lawsuit so I could create the nonprofit so that I could make money to, you know, it's like she's so open about everything. And at one point, so in San Francisco, and this is true to, again, to a certain degree in every city, the affordable nonprofit affordable housing developer world has an alliance with the tenants' rights world. And that alliance, I assume, has existed because they needed a bunch of people to show up to meetings and say, we want affordable housing. And tenants were their natural people for that. And Sonia, like, very openly was like, yeah, I'm going to try to cleave that alliance so that the affordable housing developers are divorced from the rent control complex, basically, you know. And of course, this really offended people because she's sort of saying, like, I'm going to destroy your alliance. But that's what they attempted to do. And it, of course, it was very loud and very angry. So
let's take a break and then turn to the next chapter of that story.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Okay, so this kind of starts out with like one, it's like a one-woman show.
Yes.
Doing this stuff. But she's got some money from the Yelp guy.
So the money from the Yelp guy was kind of small. Mm-hmm. But then she went and filed this lawsuit, and her and this guy, Brian Hanlon, who has gone on to become this pretty big guy in housing. But at the time, he was just working. I mean, I remember him. He was working like a job at the U.S. Forestry Service. Uh-huh. And it was clearly like not a very demanding job because he would be at all these board of supervising meetings for 3-4 hours a day when he was supposed to be working. And it was Brian and Sonia, this whole crew of people. And then it was amazing to watch happen. Then Brian just kind of tells me like, hey, I'm trying to start this thing called California YIMBY, which now has like millions of dollars from CZI, and which is the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, mm-hmm. and Stripe, and some pretty big donors have, and I think they may have 15, 20 people working for them now. Brian effectively wrote SB 827, right. which was the big upzoning bill, which then became SB 50. So you can draw a straight line from those early YIMBY meetings to SB 50. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Laura Clark, who I'm sure you're all aware of, is the effective CEO of the YIMBY. I mean, Sonia's kind of like I joke to people, I was like, Sonia's Jesus and Laura's St. Paul, which for those okay. who had humanities classes, but St. Paul was kind of the
I'm not sure if my early church history is good enough.
St. Paul was kind of the architect of Catholicism as a church rather than just kind of Jesus was kind of a wandering philosopher. Somebody has to like lay down the tablets and be like, here's how this really works, right?
Okay.
And she's built this organization, you know, with tons of members, and they give dues and they have parties, and it's kind of become this like social thing where people go to planning meetings and then, you know, go get drunk after work hopefully don't drink too much. So what's fascinating to me is the part of the way they've built this counterbalance to the single family home renter empire, if you will, is by making local politics this basically a social club.
So this kind of spread into two different directions, right? So on the one hand, you have the sort of on the ground, you know, foot soldiers, right? So there's now people who will show up to local meetings.
If you
look in the academic literature, I had Catherine Einstein on, and you know, she did this exhaustive survey of like who comes to local planning meetings in Greater Boston. And it's people who are older, whiter, richer, and much more likely to be homeowners than the overall electorate.
Yes.
Right? And so there's a conscious effort to counteract that trend, right? To not just say, well, this is what the literature says. It has to be like that. We could maybe get 20-something renters to come to meetings. And then you have Hamlin. They do lawsuits and legislation, and it's like a whole real infrastructure.
Yeah, so it's if you think about it, they have a local arm. And this is true all around the state. There's little YIMBY groups everywhere mm-hmm. now. There is the legal arm, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then there is this state arm. Mm-hmm. And you can tell me, but there seems to be some efforts to create some kind of federal arm, though that's more of a nationwide thing. But
yes.
Anyway, it was fascinating to watch how fast this infrastructure developed. And it, of course, shows you how big of a problem this is. If mm-hmm. you can't live and if you are feeling like you have no ability to get a toehold in the place where you want to live and potentially raise a family or whatever your particular desires are, that feeling of instability is going to motivate you to politics like almost nothing else is.
Right.
And I think that if this book should be on shelves 40 years from now, which if I should be so lucky, no, I'm just kind of throwing the pie in the sky out there. It'll be because this is also, aside from housing and all this stuff we're talking about, this kind of wonderful story of people discovering how accessible their democracy can mm-hmm. be to them if all they do is show up. There are people who clearly have some ambition to politics. But then there are people who just kind of discover it and accidentally get into it. And in many of the most beautiful ways, kind of just go, well, what is public policy? What is my government? What is the point of all this? Who is the mayor? How does mm-hmm. one even do that, right? And this is people kind of discovering that. And what's startling about it is you realize two things, which is things we're all constantly learning in life, which is one, nobody is in charge, right? Mm-hmm. That the world is just run by people who are, you know, maybe let's say moderately smart, but they're just kind of figuring it out like anyone else. And two, if you just start showing up to your city council meetings and requesting meetings with people and just showing up at their office, they will like start listening to you to a degree that's almost kind of startling at times. And single family homeowners clearly had a monopoly on that knowledge, and that's no longer the case. And I think you're watching, like I said, a political awakening.
I think people who care about totally other issues, that if there's just something that is frustrating you but you don't feel it's on the political radar in a correct way and feel like, well, maybe it's impossible to make changes. I mean, it's not that they've like miraculously won all their battles, but the extent to which this went from in 2012 a purely academic topic to by 2017 like a real political topic is amazing. And you have this portrait of – it's like it's not that many people, you know, who sort of made this all happen. You can count them like you know them. I have met most of these people now at, you know, a couple conferences. And then from a couple of organizers, a couple of donors, a couple of activists, it starts sprouting like politicians.
People now talk about that first YIMBY town as if it's like Woodstock or something like that. It's like, oh, I was there, you know, right?
Sure.
And there is a million things that have happened in the world, like the first Saturday Night Live cast, or there are certain physicists that were in like labs at a time of a big discovery. Mm-hmm. And all of those people went on to be someone mm-hmm. In some way, or everyone who hung out at CBGB, you know, the Talking uh-huh. Heads and Blondie, right? There are these moments in time where some explosion happens and every kind of particle that emanates from that explosion goes on to be something. And I actually think that explosion that happened in the Bay Area at that time will have influences on state and national politics. I mean, to the extent that California is always on the national radar in some way for quite some time. And not just because of housing, and I think that's so important. I obviously do think it's so important, but also because once people overcome some, let's call it activation energy, mm-hmm. which is that they've figured out where City Hall is, they've figured out how to endure a meeting, they've got certain friends, you know, they just get good at mm-hmm. it, right? Once they have that, the barrier for them to do it a second time over a second issue or a third time before is so low.
Mm-hmm.
This book kind of also delves a little bit into California history.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it's a little bit specific to California with Jerry Brown and Pat Brown, and I kind of like weaved their two stories together, the same stuff was happening all across America. They were suburbanizing at a very rapid pace. They were building a ton of freeways to accommodate the suburbanization, and it was freaking a bunch of people out. And of course, the Sierra Club and other things kind of became national movements in response to that same phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It was bigger and bolder and badder in California, but it was the same thing all around the country. There was this big event in San Francisco in the, it started in the 50s, but it really gained steam in the 60s, called the Great Freeway Revolts. Mm-hmm. And Kevin Starr, who died a couple of years ago, but he was the kind of king daddy historian of San Francisco, he always talks about how Californians were sort of apolitical at that time. A lot of them were from somewhere else. They almost thought it like wasn't their business to be getting super involved in politics. But that the freeway, well, they were going to build 8 freeways over the city of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. They started with the Embarcadero Freeway, which has since been destroyed by the earthquake. And it went right in front of the iconic ferry building.
Yep.
They were going to build 2 over Golden Gate Park. I mean, it was just a massive, horrible plan. People flipped out so hard that they mobilized and organized and started this huge neighborhood groups, all sorts of neighborhoods, to oppose the freeway revolts. You can draw a total straight line from the freeway revolts to the kind of NIMBY complex that is now fighting the people like Sonia. So that one event, those freeway revolts, created an architecture that still persists to this day. And I guess I would submit that this YIMBY activation will persist in various different forms for decades and decades.
It's a fascinating thing about the freeway revolts, because, I mean, I think you can say that the freeway revolters in San Francisco, there was a movement in Washington, D.C. It was called the Emergency Committee on the Transportation Crisis. Jane Jacobs was very involved in New York.
Yes.
And I don't know if people know this, but it's like the plan was to put a freeway – like across Houston Street in New York. In D.C., U Street, Florida Avenue would have had an inner beltway. And if you Washingtonians, you can see at the Pug, they have a poster from these days. And it says, white man's roads through black man's homes.
Yeah.
And that was the emergency committee mobilizing against it. And they really saved those cities.
100%.
You know, by blocking it. And it then created, though, a set of political institutions and norms and acculturation that the way you saved cities was by stopping projects from happening, right? And it takes it winds up taking a sour turn, even though it's the same, many times literally the same people, in all kinds of cases, the same institutions that they created. And it's the same, you know, impulse that I think is worthy, which is to say that traditional type cities like we have in the Northeast and San Francisco a little bit uniquely on the West Coast are like worth having. But at a certain point, you can't save the city by preventing anything from changing.
I totally agree. And part of the problem that we've worked ourselves into is if we were just building a little bit all the time, the city would be changing in front of our eyes all the time. But it would be like at a manageable level. Mm-hmm. And of course, we would be creating more affordable housing, you know, because it would be getting older, right? So now we're at this place where everyone wants to like open the fire hose. And that is disconcerting to people, which I, of course, get. But, you know, I always tell people, so I'm 42 years old. I was born in 1977. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a very late Gen Xer, but in many ways I really am a Gen Xer. I never really used the internet until I was a working adult. And I saw the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Nirvana together. So that makes me – Pearl Jam was the opening band and they didn't even release an album yet. So anyway, the thing about Gen Xers is they're very low birth years. So nobody cared what we thought. Aside from Bill Clinton talking about his boxer shorts on MTV, there was like no – relevance to us politically and right. And so I feel like, and as a reporter, particularly in housing, it's almost like a really great place to be because I'm sort of well aware that I'm relegated to observer status. And I feel like I'm sitting there in the middle of these two bubble generations, the baby boomers and the millennials, just like watching them go at it. But they both have the numbers to actually go at it. Yeah. Whereas like I was part of this generation where it's like, stand down, we have no numbers, you know. And so at times, I actually did feel – it is fascinating to watch this this big generational divide. And also the fact that both of those generations are so large that they need a lot of housing.
Right.
And so they're going to just inevitably disrupt, in the actual sense of that word, the course of cities, because there's so many of them that they're going to require a pretty significant alteration to how cities look, how they operate. And that's just kind of the way it goes.
This is a literal truth. I've seen a million Gen Xers on Twitter sort of lamenting the lack of Gen X voice in national politics often. But as you were saying, it's literally just a smaller number of people, right? Like that's the reason why. And then by the same token, it's like when there weren't that many new people being added to the population, the fact that it was hard to add housing was not in practice a huge deal.
Totally.
Right?
So, yeah.
But it's like there are more millennials than baby boomers because of immigration and how human reproduction works. And so, like, unless there's new houses for them, there's a problem, right? Like, it's all these people and they've got to go somewhere. And it's the opposite of neighborhood meeting thinking, which is about, like, what do I think about this block? Is like systematic thinking, which is, look, there's tens of millions of people. They're graduating from college. They got to go somewhere. Where should they go? And it seems like high wage, high demand urban areas would be a good place for people to go, in which case you would have to build houses.
100%. No, I mean, and therein lies the thing. It's kind of amazing, too, if you look at it, how, like, I don't know the exact numbers, but at the end of World War II, I think they were building like 150,000 homes a year or something. Mm-hmm. Like in the U.S., obviously the population was considered, the whole nation was like a third of the size then. And then it was like they jumped to like by like 10 times within like 3 or 4 years. I mean, in my head, I'm also like, how do they even like, I mean, there's like supply chain. How would you even like?
Where'd it come from? Yeah.
Where do you even get enough lumber, enough workers? Like, you know, I'm always fascinated by these ideas of like natural limits, meaning, you know, deficits and things like that are just like these theoretical numbers. But the actual like, how do you get enough trees to build the like, that's where the real limits are. And we have never had any kind of building boom, like to even half come even close to matching the kind of building boom we had during when the baby boomers really came online. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. Actually, you know, one of the things I'm actually really optimistic about with the economy is that even today, if you look at like the component of GDP that is building, which by and large determines a huge amount of the business cycle. In fact, this one economist wrote a paper, the title of which was, is the housing cycle the business cycle? Meaning that almost the whole thing ends up being housing. That is still so low. The amount of housing we're building right now is the lowest it's been at any time that wasn't a recession.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually, whenever I look at it, people talk in The Economist, oh, can we get to 2.5% growth? Can we get to, I'm like, actually we could if we just let that housing thing rip.
Yep.
Then we probably would eventually go into recession, but at least there'd be a like robust expansion for a couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, I read somebody today offhandedly refer to us as late in the economic cycle. I mean, it's true that we're a long time from the previous recession, but normally what late in a cycle means is essentially you've tapped out housing construction.
Yeah.
Like, because the flip side of if you have a lot of people, you need a lot of houses, is at a certain point, it's like you got enough houses, right? And then investment declines because there's no more demand for it. And we're not anywhere close to that.
Totally. And so back to kind of the politics and all that about this is at some point, whatever plan we come up with, you have to have a place to build it.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a gigantic public housing plan, go for it. Somebody's got to put it somewhere. Whether it's lots of affordable housing or in combination inclusionary zoning. I mean, what we could – your show has hashed out the political trade-offs of all these things. But at some point, you have to be able to put it somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there's never really been a constituency that – sort of anointed themselves as the people who will ensure that it can get put somewhere. And that's kind of like the arc of the book, though there are these detours, you know, where you're seeing these tenants. And one of the things that was fascinating to me is I feel like there's so much you can still learn from journalism and so much that these academic papers like do not capture. By the way, I should say, I had like an epiphany in my own like work life a couple years ago, or about a decade ago. So I used to work next to Ben Castleman, who is an economics reporter at the New York Times. He was at 538. And at that time, like the bar for a quote unquote data story was like considerably lower. And I would kind of get my Excel sheet out and go through some census data and be like, did you know that, you know, there's more of this? And then, of course, people like Ezra came along and Nate Silver, and like the bar for like a data story and like the skills you needed to have to do that story were so high that I was like, you either had to do what Ben did, which he became a computer program, he can program in R, and like he's like serious business now. And I just like retired. I was like, I am out. And I just
learned to tell stories.
Yes. Man, screw these spreadsheet stories. Like, I am out. And so I have spent so much time going around sort of trying to ask questions like, just really basic questions, like, what does displacement really look like? Mm-hmm. And so one of the stories I follow in the book is I spent, you know, pretty much like a year, but like 3 months intensely with this family. And I met them the day they got this rent increase. So they're a Latino family, live in Redwood City, which despite being in Silicon Valley is a very typical place. It's they have no renter protections, mm-hmm. no nothing. There was this community gym called the Siena Center, and it's one of these multi-purpose spaces mm-hmm. where sometimes it's got a Our Lady of Guadalupe celebration, and sometimes it's a basketball game, and sometimes it's kids doing homework and Zumba classes. And so they, of course, start doing tenant counseling because that a lot of people are mm-hmm. getting evicted in the Silicon Valley. And these people walk in with an $800 rent increase. And I just decided, I asked them, and I wanted to follow. It's like, let's just see this whole thing. Like, how do they organize? How do they find people? And what I liked about these tenants is they were like really real people. There was mm-hmm. no group they were attached to. Yeah. They were truly just like, oh my God, I got an $800. You know, they did start to organize, but this was extremely organic. Mm-hmm. But then, and spoiler, like it doesn't go very well for them and they get a crappy buyout deal. And next thing you know, they're moving out. And I asked myself, like, so who moves in, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because throughout the protest, everyone's like, Facebook, you know, is going to move in and all these things. And of course, there was another Latino family that had almost identical jobs. The men were construction workers and the mom was cleaned houses. But they just plowed like eight people into this place that used to have four. And this is like an incredibly common story mm-hmm. that is in all the literature, but not super talked about. Yep. And of course, it makes sense, right? Because the number of people who are in the Silicon Valley who actually work in tech is relatively small, but the influence they have on the economy mm-hmm. is quite large. So and it's not like these are longtime residents. These are relatively new immigrants, and they were displacing relatively new immigrants. I mean, these are all people coming to the Bay Area to enjoy, and we should encourage them to get on the escalator of betterment and wealth creation and all these things. And so as I followed these people, I just felt like the story of displacement was just very muddied in my mind mm-hmm. in terms of how it works, who's hurting, whether it's longtime residents and new, like all those things get, if you really start to spend time and follow things individually, your understanding of this issue just gets so incredibly muddied. Although I will say, the one thing I come back to time and time again is, man, this sure looks like scarcity.
Yep. You know. All right, let's take a break and then talk about some big time politics.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, WISE.com. Wise.com.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
A lot of things happen, but one of the sort of capstones of this movement has been an effort to do a big statewide rezoning. SB 50 was its most recent name, and this would just mandate that you allow more apartment construction across large swaths of California. It got a good amount of national attention for a state legislative initiative, but ultimately doesn't pass. So has anything really changed as a result of this YIMBY activism that you've been covering?
Well, I would say yes. Just the conversation changing is something, right? Mm-hmm. On top of that, there's a million other little bills that have just kind of like quietly passed in the meantime. And so Nancy Skinner, who is, you know how like sometimes there'll be in sports some big superstar, uh-huh, and everyone's trying to guard that person, and then the other person comes in, and she's kind of like that to Scott Wiener sometimes.
Right.
She passed a law that, and they actually, it was kind of funny that when they were pushing it through, they wouldn't talk about it. They like didn't want attention on it. And it essentially did the Minneapolis thing in California. You can basically do a triplex on almost any lot in California now.
It really is like a thing where it's like Wiener like ran down the field to attract a double team. And then Nancy Skinner's over there with like, oh, I have an accessory dwelling unit bill.
Exactly.
But actually the bill lets you build a 3-unit house.
It lets you split a house and put a 3 in the back. Yeah, exactly. So it's fascinating. So, and you know, to say nothing of the lawsuit bill they passed, SB 167. I don't want to give everyone the like number soup. But the point is, there's a bunch of little bills that may over time amount to at least forward progress. So that's one thing. I think the other thing is too, the fact that people are even disappointed that SB 50 failed and that it was possibly within, I mean, if there's the whole diabolical backstory is that if this legislator hadn't been off with Trump that day, they might have actually passed. Like there was this, that story is making its way. But the second SB 50 failed, mm-hmm, Tony Atkins, who is the president of the Senate in California, goes to her microphone and says, you're going to have to compromise because we're going to pass something about this year. Whether or not that ends up being the case, she's putting her credibility pretty heavily on the line there. Then Gavin Newsom, who has unapologetically gone after every issue you can possibly go after, healthcare, whatever else, is his latest State of the State speech, he only talked about housing. So I feel like if that would have been introduced 5 years ago, people, it would just been like, what the hell is this? Like,
sure.
You know. So by the way, I will say it was pretty funny. When SB 50 was happening, I was on Twitter and I wrote, oh, I'm such a homebody that my Twitter feed is, it was like the same time as impeachment.
Yep.
I was like, that my Twitter feed is like 10 to 1 SB 50 to impeachment. And somebody tweeted back to me, you should follow this account because it only focuses on national issues. And it was Gavin Newsom's Twitter account.
Right.
And I do think, I mean, that stupid Twitter joke aside, I do think there's polling and there's criticism that was really starting to hold, that he was not focusing on the state's biggest issue. It's not a coincidence that he made his state of the, I mean, he's not some guy who just like accidentally does things.
But so this is like politics are tough, right? Because so California is a very democratic state, right? So one strand of how you think about politics is you're Democratic governor of California. It's a very democratic state. You have strong democratic state legislatures. So you want to focus the agenda on topics that unite your coalition. And that means finding ways for the state to fight Trump on immigration. It means finding ways for the state to fight Trump on healthcare, right? Because that's what, like, all of Gavin Newsom's voters don't like Donald Trump. They, you know, this is like what they want them to do, whereas this housing topic is the opposite. It's like Scott Wiener's bill had some Republican support. It's opposed by a lot of lefty groups. It's like people are fighting with each other. And if you can duck it, right, like that's smart. But then the flip side is you want your constituents to agree with you, but you also need to deliver on problems that impact people and that you have control over. And like Gavin Newsom can't make Donald Trump go away, but Californians experience housing-related problems in their lives. And, you know, Jerry Brown got through two terms not really doing anything on housing, but people liked him. But it seems like Newsom is feeling pressure to do something.
So Jerry Brown, obviously, the Great Recession was his big thing, and right. The housing thing didn't really bubble up till the end. Jerry Brown also, like as you said, had the cult of Jerry Brown around him. And he could control the legislators sometimes just like by being Jerry Brown.
Uh-huh.
And
he was like this like old wizard of
yeah,
California
exactly.
politics, right?
And you know, people knew him. They like, it's funny because I remember when Meg Whitman ran against him, people were saying like, oh, she has so much money. I'm like, I don't care how much money she has. Like everybody knows his name and he can walk into any town in California and just like identify their longstanding problem mm-hmm. and like what's that worth? And the other problem is you can't really solve this housing problem. Like there's no winning here. Uh-huh. And that's like a really annoying issue to take on. Yeah. But my whole thing is whatever, beyond the vanity and the whatever reasons people get into politics, like at some point, people talk about leadership. It's not really mm-hmm. a leadership job. It's kind of like whatever problem is happening at that time, sorry, you're stuck with that.
Right.
And like it's a job in which like things are kind of handed to you.
Right.
And I think like housing is what's been handed to him.
Right.
So have at it.
I mean, because, you know, you think about like what did Jerry Brown accomplish? And it was a lot, but it was he took office at a time when people were just like really worried about the budget. And
yes.
the recession and the fiscal impact. Whereas now, you know, it's 2021. Nobody's going to be impressed that in the midst of a like thriving California economy that like you matched spending to revenues.
Yeah.
Right. It's like, but housing.
Anyway, so I think that Gavin is stuck with this problem that he can't really run on for president because let's be real here. It's but this is what California needs. It's what California wants. And by the way, on a separate topic, the first time I met Sonia, we met for coffee at this cafe in Oakland. And she says to me, it's not just that these people show up and do this. It's that they are greeted as like heroes. They are invariably kind of described somewhere between an anti-capitalist and a like steward of good taste and community and design mm-hmm. and all these different things. And she's like, what I need to change is that person is seen as like a selfish asshole, that showing uh-huh. up to that meeting, I mean, she overdoes it, right? But I just meant uh-huh. this was her, I'm not saying I advocate this position. I'm saying this is a quote, right? And what is startling to me is that seems to have happened. I always make mm-hmm. the comparison to gay marriage where gay marriage went from something people could like your uncle who's a conservative mm-hmm. could like reasonably be like, I don't hate gay people, but I just don't think they should be married. And people would, they're not that long ago, people would accept that. Well, we're working on him. He just thinks a different way, right? Mm-hmm. And like within a very short period of time, it went from that to you're like out if you mm-hmm. or don't believe in gay marriage. On top of that, when the Supreme Court case happened, I remember there was a great article in the New York Times about how they couldn't even get like a really good lawyer to argue right. the other side. I hate to put it this way, but it was almost like thought police took over uh-huh. the issue. And she very openly was like, I kind of want to attach a new kind of thought police to this issue where you don't just get you have to feel like there is some degree of social risk mm-hmm. if you show up to these meetings and take over. This is the way this connects to Gavin Newsom is I think that these younger voters are starting to absorb this lesson. They have much like this free revolt thing we talked about, they've absorbed this ethos that more housing is more just and better and all these things. So I think Gavin actually has to contend with the fact that even if this is not, quote unquote, a winning issue, there is still a large number, large and increasing number of voters who are basically in support of some kind of housing thing.
I think this framing topic that you raise is critical, and it brings us back to someone we were talking about at the beginning. But I know from like Frank Baumgartner's research, and his big point in this book is like things normally just don't change. Like it doesn't matter what the topic is. The American political system is averse to changing. And one of the things that does make change happen is that how an issue is understood, like what is the topic, gets framed differently. So one of his examples is death penalty activism, which at a certain point switched from it's about cruelty to it's about innocence. And with marriage equality, right? It's a switch from this is about redefining marriage to this is about civil rights for gay couples, right? And with housing is the question of you flip it from is this about, you know, neighborhood defenders against rapacious capitalism, or is it about the selfishness of incumbent homeowners against change, right? And it's the same people. It's the same topic. Like, it's the same thing, but different stories get written depending on who and even who do we understand, right? Because there's such a convention in old-time urban journalism of portraying the developers as the powerful group and the people at the meeting as the underdogs, right? And I think what you said this to me before, but that's not the case. Like, homeowners hold a lot of political power.
They have a ton of political power. In fact, so this guy, Harvey Mulich, who John Logan and Harvey Mulich wrote this great book called Urban Fortunes. And they have this concept called the growth machine. And the basic idea is that all of a city is oriented towards growth. This is sometimes in every city, this is colloquially referred to as downtown, right? And this, Bill Fischel, who is the economist who wrote this home voter hypothesis that basically posits that single-family homeowners control everything, basically says the growth machine has been challenged. Like, that was his framework. So
I think part of the way you can think about what Scott Wiener was trying to do is sort of put the growth machine back together, because this is posited to be, you know, developers are an important part of the growth machine, but it wins by having a broader constituency, including construction workers, public sector unions who need the tax revenue, things like that. And I think the sort of views of construction labor has been a missing piece in what we've been talking about.
Totally. So one of the things I think – I forget which book I was reading, but one of the books kind of talks about how – maybe they didn't frame it this way, but the way I interpret it is there used to be like a really healthy tension in cities where there were unions, private sector unions, which were all for all intents and purposes gone, who fought back against management. And then there was management and corporations who – you know, tried to enhance productivity by, you know, pushing new automation, whatever, right? And then there was single-family homeowners pushing against commercial businesses. You know, there was all these different kind of interest groups, and they were warring with each other, and one would win, one would lose, one would win, one would lose. And the net effect was that we created a healthy, vibrant city. And then once that gets taken over by only single-family homeowners, it becomes just this mono thing where everything in the city is constructed more or less to inflate home values and keep this one constituency happy. So I think construction workers, I feel like they're a missing piece of this equation. I mean, they're always there, don't get me wrong, but they don't seem to be a big enough constituency to have really turned things. And construction is like the only – outside of the Midwest where they still do have a substantial number of factories for all the rot notwithstanding, it's like the only blue-collar job – it's like the only job that somebody who did not go to college can make a pretty decent living, because in the Bay Area, construction workers make anywhere from $40 to $60 an hour.
Yeah, this is where I always want to see housing pulled into the national conversation, is not as a housing topic per se, but exactly as you say, it's a labor market topic. Like, I see people standing around being like, well, what are we going to do if there's not as much manufacturing work anymore? Or like, it's all coming from China. But yeah. It's like, you don't import a fucking apartment building from China. Those are jobs. And now if you could say, well, we can't get people doing construction work because we have such housing plenty that nobody would possibly want to live in any new houses. Like, that'd be one thing, but we're clearly not there, right? So it's a solution on the consumption side, but also on the job side, very critically, and one that seems so much more promising to me than these like trade antics, because there's like a good reason you don't import houses.
Totally, and construction is it's skilled, it's thoughtful, it's not, you cannot just go be a construction worker tomorrow. It takes like a lot of work. I spent a lot of time for the book with a modular construction factory in Vallejo. Many of the people I met in that factory were like, one woman actually used to be a waitress and she made like $12 an hour plus tips. Now they make $30 an hour. I'm not here to say this man is the savior of the American labor market and he's a good capitalist. And I mean, I do say that in the book, but I didn't say the savior part. But I just think like we're not talking enough about how to create new jobs.
Yeah.
One of the things I really admired about the union that was in that factory is in California, this is probably true nationally too, there's a carpenters union and it's kind of a little separate from the building trades union.
Yeah.
But if you look at like what the carpenters union does, they're like, they go and they organize like crazy. They see their role the way a union used to see their role, to like sit there and beat the shit out of management until they get what they want, and fight hard for workers and you know, better pay, better benefits, better hour, all these things, right? But they're not like, I mean, don't get me wrong, they have a presence in this capital, but they're not like so over the top focused on legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Like they see their role as, if I'm going to increase the labor share of income, I mean, to take it to macro for a second, I'm going to go, you know, fight like fucking hell with management and get the worker a better wage, a better life.
So before I let you go, I like to ask people, you know, what did we miss here? What should I have asked you about?
Good question. I guess the thing you should have asked me about is, well, I'm going to turn it back on you.
There you go.
I'm here with you, Matt, in our nation's capital.
There it is.
And I spend so much time thinking about state and local politics, mostly state politics, but local as well. And I almost like sort of ignore DC as I read about it, and I'm very grateful to my colleagues at the New York Times for covering it so wonderfully. But I just like don't think that much about the federal government, at least no more than any other like moderately educated voter. Let's just say somebody who has proposed some sort of national zoning reform in some fashion or form got elected and decided, I'm really going to pursue this. What do you think that would really look like? I haven't thought very much about this. Like, would they tie highway funding? Like, how would this really look?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most promising venue is to do it through the Surface Transportation Bill, which dispenses highway funding and mass transit funding. The sort of small way to do it is to connect it to the New Starts grants, which are for mass transit. The vast majority of the United States doesn't care about the New Starts program, but the handful of cities that do try to get that money, if they were told, look, as part of your application, you need to show us that you are doing a robust zoning reform, that would have a big impact in a small number of places. I think the risk with that is that you don't tackle the sort of exclusionary suburbs, right? Because, you know, if you're talking about even in a relatively transit-oriented metro area, you know, Newton, Massachusetts, they don't care, right? They're not applying for a New Starts grant. It would only be the city of Boston that would be invested in that. So then the really big lever would be you attach it to highway funding, right, which every state legislature cares about. And you would have some formula and you would say, look, if your state is underperforming on some housing affordability index, like you need to make some kind of changes. The question about could you get that done, I think, has so much to do with ultimately what is the attitude of Republicans, right? Republicans are not super relevant in California, although their votes did wind up mattering on SB 50. But, you know, the Trump administration will say, I think correctly, diagnose the housing problem in blue states. But they do it mostly to troll rather than as an effort to make public policy, right? So like Trump like put out a thing and he's like, homelessness is terrible in California. And then, you know, he does his tweets. And, then
his complaint about homelessness was that basically foreign billionaires buy amazing condos in L.A.
Yeah,
and they have to look at homeless people. I was like, do you remember that comment? It was crazy.
Right. And then if you delve into like the footnotes of his CEA report, like it says what Obama's CEA report said, which is correct, which is that the zoning is bad. But then when they had this vote in the state legislature, it's not like he didn't whip state Senate votes for SB 50. Right. And several Republicans voted against it. And if they'd all been for it, it would have passed. Right. So in Congress, one of the Idaho senators has become this like YIMBY guy. But again, it's not clear if he's trying to get something done, Mike Braun, or if he's just trying to troll blue state liberals. Right. If Republicans want to say that they have deregulatory ideas that will boost economic growth, help working class Americans, and solve a major national problem. Like, housing is the place where, like, that is true, right? And the Republican Party is a big deal in national politics. And if they united with the YIMBY faction of progressives, like, they could win. Right. But the flip side of Republicans is the instinct to side with, you know, normative, older, whiter, suburban homeowners and do what they want, which in this case is not deregulate. And if that's going to be the attitude, then it's just as hard to do anything.
I think the problem with the Republican Party in California is that they, beyond the obvious brand problem with Trump, is they don't advertise. I mean, and that's why when people say California is an all-Democratic state, I'm like, I don't know that that's really relevant anymore because the stripes are so different.
But it's like they've given up.
But you're kind of reminding me of – and this is a great kind of weird counterintuitive note to end on. You're kind of reminding me of – I remember being – I think I was even in Washington, D.C. talking to somebody from Brookings, and I was saying, you know, this is years ago, probably like 2012 or something, and I was like, what would it really take to get rid of the mortgage interest deduction? And he was like, oh, I hope Obama – maybe under the cover of night they could do it, right? Mm-hmm. He was like – and then, of course, Trump does it in like, you know, in like 3 days in December, right? And and I – it's fascinating to me that it's not really gone, but it is effectively gone.
Yeah.
It's funny to me that maybe what happens is that Republican senators decide they have this deregulatory agenda and they end up solving the same problem. That would actually be kind of funny.
Yeah. I mean, I think that would be – in a national context, that would be the most plausible route. All right. Connor Doherty, New York Times. The book is Golden Gates. Thank you so much. Thanks, as always, to Malachi Brodus, our engineer, Jackson Bierfeld, our editor, Jeff Gelb, producer, and The Weeds will be back on Tuesday.
Support for this podcast came from SAS. Data is everything. And now everything is data, which means more to process, more to analyze. And now more than ever, speed to answers matters. So how do you produce those answers as fast as the world produces data? With SAS Viya, the quickest way from a billion points of data to a point of view. It's a more productive data and AI platform that helps you get more done. Learn more today at sas.com/VIYA.